Shall we begin?
You're listening to the Dishin' and Swishin' podcast on HoopFeed.com.
Hi, everybody. It's David Siegel, and I'm pleased to welcome you to another Dishin' and Swishin' podcast on HoopFeed.com. And we're going to have some fun this week because, you know, instead of talking with some of the players and coaches that have made this NCAA season great, one of the things that really has picked up a lot of steam over the last couple of years is these mock drafts for the WNBA now. I think it's fantastic that people are looking at the WNBA in the same light that they look at the NBA draft and the NFL draft. And, you know, mock drafts have been a staple to message boards, but I'm pleased to welcome a first-timer to the Dishin' and Swishin' podcast, and that is XL Sports' Howard Megdahl, who Howard has been taking on the adventure of a lifetime to many fans in trying to do a weekly update of a mock draft for the WNBA based on research that he does with extensive time and commitment, and it's been a lot of fun. We're in week two, and Howard, welcome to the podcast, first of all.
I'm so excited to be here as someone who has been a long-time listener.
Well, that's certainly appreciated. You know, Howard, the time commitment that you have to put into this, I just want to start first by, you looked at your week one draft and you look at your week two and you see the changes, and it shows clearly you did an awful, in a 7-day period between watching games, reading up on teams, talking to people, it's clear that you put in an overwhelming amount of time.
Well, I think that's really important. You know, I'm always conscious of the fact that especially because, like you said, there aren't a lot of these being done, that people are going to read and pay attention to it. The players are going to read it and pay attention to it. And, you know, part of me would like to, you know, put everyone first. But obviously you have to do it as intelligently as you can and inform the fans as much as you possibly can. There's sort of an added responsibility because it's not just sort of one drop in the ocean. But, you know, one of the relatively rare places where you get a chance to see it. The other part of it is that just as a basketball junkie, this is just basically unending fun. I get to, as my job, watch a ton of games. I get to talk to people around the league. I get to talk to college coaches. I get to talk to scouts and get a sense of, look, this is what I'm seeing. What are you seeing? What do you think of this player? What do you think of that player? How does this player project? I mean, so it's just remarkably enjoyable. And so, yeah, there's a lot of time that's being put into it, and, you know, that will only increase in the coming weeks ahead. But it's worth it and certainly rewarding.
Let's take a step back before we start getting a little more into some detail, and let's talk about XL Sports in general. It's a new internet publication. It's focused on women's sports, and it certainly is something that, at least to date, what I've seen is very, very impressive. Both the articles and the comments that are being made in there, and also the look. It's a clean, nice, easy to read periodical.
Well, it's great to hear, and you know what XL Sports believes. And I certainly believe this as well, and I met with them and was happy to join them as a contributing editor specializing mainly in basketball and soccer, is that there was a real enormous gap between the amount of women's sports and the amount of coverage that we saw for women's sports. And there's sort of a twofold issue there, one being that there's a lack of integration of women's sports coverage within the larger sports media landscape. But there's another problem, and maybe a more basic problem, which is that the day-to-day of women's sports is simply not covered in a comprehensive way. And the net result of that is that you're asking people to watch and care about women's sports, the casual fan, that is, without giving them the basic text, allowing them to follow what's going on. I equate it to asking someone to watch a telenovela on Univision without teaching them how to speak Spanish first. And so to be a part of bridging that gap within the media was something that I thought was very important. And XL Sports, you know, something well-funded, something with large intentions, something with the ability to cover the sport on a day-to-day basis is just so welcome. And you know, even already to be able to do what I'm doing, you know, a WNBA mock draft, yes, but also to go up to Albany and be able to do a long-form profile of Sharisha Richards, at the same time be able to write a possible free agent destination column about Sue Bird, who re-signed with Seattle, but at the time it was written, still hadn't, and even being able to break news, you know, when the Chicago Sky went ahead and brought Clarissa Dos Santos back. We were able to be first on that. And so that combination of in-depth coverage, which I plan to bring to soccer as well, and which Excel Sports plans to bring throughout the women's sports spectrum, is, I think, really important and something really new in terms of day-to-day coverage.
And also, we would be remiss if we didn't mention you, right alongside Michelle Vopel of ESPN, had the first interviews with new league president Lisa Borders as well. So that right away shows the respect that you're getting from the league office when you had the president when you had access to the president that quickly.
Well, yeah, I mean, the league understands that there needs to be regular coverage, and that's to take nothing away from Michelle, who, as we were discussing before we came on the show, is one of my favorite writers and one of my favorite people. But it also comes down to being able to properly staff and go out there and cover on a regular basis everything that's going on, beyond just even the confines of what Excel Sports is able to cover. And, we plan to highlight the writing and the podcasting and the audiovisual work that's being done, covering the sport all over the country and be a hub for it so that when people come to Excel Sports, they're going to be able to see everything that's going on.
Well, let's get back on point and talk about a little bit about the mock draft process. Now, one of the things that I know, and anybody that follows you on Twitter knows, is you are definitely one of those stats guys. You're a Sabermetrics fan. That is clear. How much in your draft analysis goes the numbers themselves versus, you know, the what I call the eye test, or some of the, and then where does that all fit in with comments you get from coaches and scouts and such?
Well, it's fascinating, right? So there's how I view it, and then there's how the league views it, which varies greatly, and there's still a significant amount of ground to cover between the way the most sabermetrically intense WNBA team looks at the draft and the way the more, let's say, eye-test intensive teams look at it. So when I'm trying to put together a mock draft, it's a combination of, all right, how do I view a specific player? How do I view what a specific player can be? How do I view what a specific player can be for that team? And then there's the fourth factor, which is, well, does that team and will that team feel the same way? I might view a player as a particularly good fit for a specific roster, but that team may not view it the same way. And to be frank, I'm still sort of getting my mind around the proper way to balance all of those things when I put together a mock draft. And it's a complicated factor, and my favorite part about it has been how many people have been disagreeing. And I'm certainly not a writer who would object to that, not the least of which because it's a mock draft. There's no way I'm going to get it right. There's no way I'm going to get it close to right. I'm going to put it together as best I can, but it should be the start of a discussion, and there should always be tremendous discussion around it. And in much the same way that the NBA draft is a feeder for interest and energy and conversation about the NBA, and same with the NFL and even increasingly in MLB, it's really what should be for the WNBA. There's a huge audience for women's college basketball, and there's a significantly large audience for the WNBA, and tying those two things together is something that I just don't think is done enough, and I'm not sure why, but I intend to do it.
Well, that is an excellent point that you just made, and that is one of the things that people don't seem to get sometimes, is there is a disconnect between the women's game in college and pro. And it's not just the fact that the players are there, but there's, you know, a lot of people may call it the our girls syndrome or whatever the case may be, but there seems to be ownership that people take towards the college kids, and then when they start to move on to the pros, there's less interest. a perfect example of that is here in my state in Connecticut, where UConn is, you know, obviously one of the preeminent fan-related programs in the country, yet the Connecticut Sun seems to go back and forth between, you know, are the fans there to see UConn players or are they there to see winning basketball?
Well, and you need to look no further than media to be able to figure out why that is, in my opinion. And, you know, for all the theories and the conversation and, you know, sort of blaming women for not coming out in support of women's sports and all that nonsense, right? You put that aside because look at UConn. UConn has been treated like a major league team by the Connecticut newspapers. So when I went out to NCAA Women's Basketball Media Day at ESPN Studios at the start of this year, there were, I don't know, maybe four of us from various national publications, and then there were six Connecticut newspapers represented there as well. And that is a clear and consistent thing, something that's gone on, as you know, for a long time. And as a result, Connecticut has a consistent audience. There's a consistent level of support. You know, I went to UConn, Nebraska on Thanksgiving weekend off campus, and you had 10,000 people, you know, who came to Hartford on, you know, a lousy day to come out. And that's just the reality of UConn. And when teams are covered regularly, you know, Phil Kaplan does a great job, you know, with the paper down in Knoxville for the University of Tennessee as well. And the net result is that people are able to follow it regularly. People understand the storylines because those storylines are spelled out regularly. You saw it just this past summer and on a larger scale with the way that Fox promoted and covered the Women's World Cup. And by treating it like a sporting event, you know, as if this is revolutionary. I mean, it's the craziest thing imaginable. But you treat women's sports like you treat men's sports, and people want to watch it in much the same way. In fact, you ended up with a greater audience for the Women's World Cup final than you had for any men's soccer game in the history of the United States. And it wasn't just the final. You had millions of people watching every U.S. game, and you had audiences for weekday afternoon group games involving non-U.S. teams that would outdraw what, say, MLS does on a Sunday night. And so that's the reality of it, and that's what needs to change in a fundamental way. And what you said as far as it relates to UConn versus the Connecticut Sun is a great example. The Connecticut Sun should and hopefully will be treated as more and more of a significant team going forward. Of course, they could have had a slightly higher pick in this upcoming draft. That probably would have helped matters.
Yes, it definitely would have helped matters. Although, you know, if in fact one of the other two, either Mariah Jefferson or Morgan Tuck instead of Breonna Stewart, end up in Connecticut, it would certainly be something that the crowds would be in favor of. But, you know, the other thing is when you look at this, when you look at the inexact science of doing a mock draft, the other variable that I was thinking about that you don't know is what else is going on. Mm-hmm. You know, when you first did this, you know, you mentioned that you had a fun write up as to where Sue Bird could possibly end up. Now,
right.
We all anticipated that she was going to be back in Seattle, which of course she now is. But it was still, you know, perfect example of, you know, this would change based on if, in fact, she had ended up in Chicago or ended up in Connecticut. You know, when you try to do this, you don't know what else is going on in a general manager's mind.
Exactly right. And so that's where these conversations have been so useful, and I plan to continue them and increase them in the coming weeks as well. But, right, had Connecticut been able to convince Sue Bird to come back, to the state. You could leave aside the eruption that would have been both in Seattle, where, you know, she is, you know, treated like royalty and rightfully so, but also being able to return to her college stomping grounds. But what it also would have done is it would have solved a significant issue that Connecticut has, which is to say that in a perfect world, they would find a point guard with some size to be able to play alongside Alex Bentley. But that player may not be available, and in my opinion is not available, at the upper reaches of the draft. And so they have picks 3 and 4, and they're going to have to figure out a way to square that circle. It's going to be a challenging thing for them to do, and I'm still trying to figure out how they're going to do it, and they're still trying to figure out how they're going to do it as well.
And the interesting thing also that goes into that is, you know, there's development issues that go into players too. Again, you know, it happens to be, it's just ironic that Connecticut is a good example of, for a lot of these things, but it is a young team that is trying to build things. You know, they had invested last year in Chelsea Gray. Is Chelsea Gray ready to step up and be a number one point guard? Is she ever going to step up and be a number one point guard? Or do they, you know, are they prepared to make that commitment, or do they look to make a move to try and get another point guard? So all of this does go into these discussions. And then you get the shooting star theory, which I always say, and that right now would be one Rachel Banham, if you look on the message boards, I think they have her going, you know, thinking that she could compete with Stewart for the number one pick. But, you know, yet you deal in reality, and you have to look at the fact that this is a very talented player, but where does she fit and where is her long-term career going to go? No one's really quite sure. She is coming off of the knee injury, and she has shown limitations in other aspects of her game. But then you see these explosions where she is certainly a talented offensive player.
Well, so let me say this about Rachel Banham, and I laugh just in terms of Breanna Stewart, just because I don't think there's ever been anything more certain in a sport of any kind than the fact that the Seattle Storm will take Breanna Stewart number one in the draft. You know, it was so striking to me when I went to cover the draft lottery, how all four of the teams involved, you know, no one even pretended that they weren't disappointed if they didn't get her, or, you know, get the number one pick, or what that would mean, and it wasn't any sort of disrespect to anyone else in the draft. It was just so clear that, you know, she has this array of skills that largely no one's ever seen, you know, in collection before. We should have a different conversation about how every time that is said, there's this thought in the back of my head, which is like, well, 90% of that, though, is Elena Deladon, and you know, that's a whole other conversation. That's going to be an interesting rivalry in the years to come, without question. But that said, to your Rachel Banham question, leaving Breanna Stewart aside, and frankly, leaving Mariah Jefferson aside, who, to my mind, has to be the clear number two for a variety of reasons we can get into, Rachel Banham does a number of things remarkably well. She is a tremendous shooter. She is an extremely good rebounder for her size. You'll notice that even in the game where she scored 35 against Iowa and hit this ridiculous falling down game-winning three, she also had 9 rebounds, and that's significant. And she also had 8 assists, and that says a lot. You know, there's this. She gets a lot of shots up, and part of that, you know, has to do with her being, you know, a significant focal point in the Minnesota offense. But part of that is pace. And it's really important, you know, you talked about the sabermetric aspect of it. It's worth going and looking at points per possession and defensive points per possession when it comes to evaluating teams. Like, you know, teams are, there's a lot of talk about South Carolina as this, like, defensive juggernaut. And they're actually, in terms of the national rank, ahead offensively of where they are defensively if you go by points per possession. Their scores are artificially low because they play at a slow pace. And Minnesota's the reverse. Minnesota's a better defensive team. They're not a great defensive team, but they're a better defensive team than they get credit for. And offensively, Rachel Banham's not some sort of indiscriminate shooter. She's very good at finding her teammates. She's very good at running that offense, and that is key. When you think about what she can be at the next level, in the same way, you know, that we talked quite a bit about Tiffany Mitchell at the next level, and there's a conversation about her as sort of a consensus top five. I have her number three right now. She's a terrific player. She's a plus defensive player. But Tiffany Mitchell, if she is not a point guard at the next level, is she undersized as a 5'9"? I don't know. And when you look at her assist percentage, which rather than total assists, you're looking at assists per 100 possessions, her assist percentage lags well behind Rachel Banham's. So thinking about the two of them, about, all right, who's going to play the point and who's going to be a more effective one at the next level? Well, there's a lot of indications that Banham's going to make that transition a little better than Mitchell will even. So as far as where she goes and, you know, essentially 127 points over three games, we'll get a lot of conversation about that. I think it is going to come down to team need, and this is such a position-rich draft in terms of bigs. That may end up working to her advantage as well, or you may see a whole bunch of teams try and solidify the five position, you know, and do that early on. But frankly, if she's picked anywhere third down, it will not surprise me. I have her ninth right now. I have her going to Indiana where, I mean, she's made for Steph White in like a variety of ways. But would she go higher? Is that a possibility? I mean, could you see her in Phoenix? Sure, of course. Could you see her as a counterpoint to the twin bigs in Washington? Absolutely. I mean, there are a lot of places that could use Rachel Banham.
That's for sure. And, you know, then, of course, the other thing that you got to look at, there's two other. You have the issue of the underclassmen, and you have two of them listed this week, and that's Morgan Tuck and Ariel Powers, both of which I would agree will be top picks should they both decide to come out and go pro. And then you always get that small school or competition discussion, and you've got Jonquel Jones from George Washington and Charissa Richards, who are both very strong inside players. And actually, to an extent, you could raise the argument about Jillian Aline, too, even though she's from, you know, a Pac-12 school. There is questions about the competition that she's had inside, too. All factors that are difficult to weigh.
What do you think of that? Because to me, the Pac-12 is playing as quality a level of basketball as I have seen this year. And, you know, to be frank, I'm irritated with the Pac-12 because there's so much good basketball going on out there. And, you know, I have two young children, and it's late at night. And, you know, I'm looking to get some sleep, and I'm not able to do so because there are too many compelling matchups. But do you think that's fair? Do you think that – I know you're supposed to be asking me the questions, but do you think that's fair as it relates to the Pac-12?
I think that when I look at this, when I look at the way people are looking at things regarding the Pac-12, it seems mm-hmm. that everybody's in love with Oregon State this year. Mm-hmm. And other than that, I think that some of the other teams and players are getting some shortchanged.
Yeah. I think there's
tremendous. I mean,
UCLA?
Yep, absolutely. And, you know,
even Utah. Even Utah is not talked about enough, but Utah has a ton of talent on that team.
You know, the whole group, Arizona State in particular, you know, it's tough to over – you always look at Arizona State and they have, you know, so many people running in and out that it's tough to tell who the top players are when you just look at numbers. You know, mm-hmm. that's where you fall into the category, like you said, about being able to watch the games.
Right.
You know, you need to do that on a team like an Arizona State where everybody plays 20 minutes a game.
Mm-hmm. And it is
difficult, and it is difficult to appraise them as you look to them in the future. And when you don't get a chance to see a lot of those games, that's why it was so much fun a couple weeks ago when ESPN had a 9 o'clock tip off between Oregon State and I think it was Arizona State. Yeah, that was the game. Mm. You know, that was great. I wish they would do more of that instead of running. You know, no offense to Louisville and South Florida, but I can see them at 7 o'clock. Why do I have to watch them at 9 o'clock, like last night?
Very true, although South Florida is so much fun to watch, right? You know, Courtney Williams, but also, you know, they're freshmen shooting threes. I'm blanking on her name, but just such a quick release on it, and just a tremendously impressive play. You know, Doug Feinberg mentioned to me, yesterday, you know, it'd be so interesting to do a mock draft when, if we knew that everyone was available for it, right? And if they did so, Kitty Alaksa.
Yep.
Just the way she shoots, I think some team would just grab her and plug her in at the three tomorrow in the WNBA, even though I know she's only a freshman.
Mm-hmm. No, I think you're right. I think that there's a lot of intriguing underclassmen to keep an eye on. And I would say that what I would submit to you is the number two person in that draft would not my UConn allegiance showing here, would not be Mariah Jefferson. It would be Kelsey Mitchell if she were available.
Yeah, no, and I think there's a lot to that. You know, Audra Wilson as well, South Carolina.
Yep.
But, you know, Mitchell just gets her shots off so quickly. It's going to be fascinating to see. It really does come down to, with her in a way that I don't think it comes down to with Rachel Banham, an issue of shot selection, but she has time to figure that out, and I think she's going to. And she's also really underrated defensively. So it'll be fascinating to see her. I'm just in terms of the players that you mentioned, you know, and I wrote about them this week, you know, Morgan Tuck is one of my favorite players to watch in the game, by which I mean she is able to get to her spot so frequently, it astounds me. She is not going to be the fastest player out there. She is only 6'2", and she's largely asked to play the four in the Connecticut offense. And she somehow manages, just over and over again, to grab the necessary rebound, to go ahead and find the right spot, to set the perfect pick for Breanna Stewart. And so in that way, you see, it's like the difference when she was out for a couple weeks. It was the difference between UConn, you know, not that they lost in that time, but having the two best players in college basketball in Jefferson and Stewart makes them the best team in the country. You add Tuck to that mix, and there's just another gear that they hit. And so thinking about her as a WNBA player, that's enticing to a lot of teams, but, you know, the thing that I think probably makes people nervous is, you know, having had the knee issue that she had earlier this year, number one. And number two, the fact that there's not, let's say, that one carrying tool where you say, okay, well, she shoots 40% from three, or, you know, look, her rebounding percentage is, you know, up over 20, you know, or something along those lines. But she does everything well, and she's so smart. It's almost impossible for me to conceive of her as anything other than a big success in the WNBA. And then as far as Ariel Powers goes, her reach, I think they list her at 6 foot. And so you would think, well, that's problematic. But it really isn't, because her reach alone will allow her, you would think, to easily guard threes in this league. And her ball handling, passing skills are such that, you know, she's really just a swing person in a positionless league, and this is becoming a positionless league more and more with each passing year. If she could start hitting threes on a regular basis, she takes a lot of them, but I think she's around 29.2% this year. She'd be an all-star, but she's going to be a contributor regardless, and just really impressive to see.
I agree. I think that she does have to continue to work on that, but you know, there's so much. It seems that when you look at this year's draft, there's a lot of very talented players, no denying that. But it seems that other than the very top, there's something missing. You know, you mentioned with Tiffany Mitchell, there's, you know, where is she going to play with Tuck?
Right.
You wonder, same thing. Can she play the three? Boyette has never shown that fire in the belly that you want to see.
Can we talk about, because I had this argument on Twitter, and I think it's so interesting. Imani Boyette does more right than virtually any player in this draft. If you were looking at a combination, you talked about stats versus the eye test, right?
Yes.
Okay. In terms, stats and the eye test seem to be in conflict with her, but stats and projectability are not. And that's often the combination that you're really running into, right? Where you say, all right, well, you know, you're not seeing the projection turning into production yet. But with Imani Boyette, and I hear that all the time, she didn't have the fire in the belly or this or that, the stats are reflective of turning those potential skills into skills. If you look at her rebound rate, I don't have it in front of me, but it's something like 24% available rebounds. I mean, she is among the very best in the country. When you look at blocked shots, she is up around, I want to say 7% of available blocked shots, up around top 15 in the country as well. One of the few players who is both top 15 at last check in both rebounding and blocked shots. And she's not some sort of limited shooter. She's made some threes. She is dangerous right up and out to the three-point line. It is easy to imagine you get her in the right system. You, I mean, you know, if she ends up in Washington, for instance, not that they need her, but Mike Tebow would obviously have her shooting threes the way he does with Dolson, the way he did with Emily Eastman last year. So some coach gets a hold of her, adds that to the game easily enough. But she's also, and this cannot be overstated, she's 6'7". You look at the other bigs who are in this draft, and they're generally 6'3", 6'4". You know, Brianna Stewart's a different question altogether in terms
right.
of everything she brings. She's 6'7" and has everything that comes with. You know, she'll be the second tallest WNBA player other than Brittany Griner. And there is significance that goes with that in an array of ways that your skills translate better to the next level because you're not essentially out-muscled or outreached for various balls and at various times. So to my mind, Imani Boyette, who, you know, again, she struggled in some big games. She's played well in others. I see less wrong with Imani Boyette's game other than this, you know, this sort of ephemeral fire in the belly issue that I don't see much evidence of. And if I was drafting purely on talent, purely on skill, purely on projection, she would be number three. Of course, she, in a way that seems perfect for the way the Connecticut Sun have been, given poor luck as a result of this draft, she's a terrible fit for Connecticut because of, you know, the large number of bigs they already have.
You know, the other question that I have about her, though, is, you know, the numbers that you give, this is the, you know, the counter to the sabermetrics, you
right.
know, reflect a 6'7 player in the NCAA,
mm-hmm.
Where, you know, you have some teams, you know, you have Temple that played five guards against UConn this week.
Right.
You know, yet when you go to the pros, and now, you know, let's say that she does go out to the West and go to L.A., specifically
mm-hmm.
like you have in the draft.
Mm-hmm.
Now she's playing against Brittany Griner, Brianna Stewart. She's playing against, does San Antonio even have, Jane Appel,
mm-hmm.
you know, another big body. You know, she's going against Sylvia Fowles. You know, what does that do? Do those numbers translate when you're now suddenly going against, full-grown adult-sized women that have played internationally and gone against people her size?
So there are two answers to that as far as I can see. One of them is, you know, you could turn around and ask the very same question about every one of these players, plus you add in the fact that, you know, there's a lack of that additional height. There's a lack of that additional reach. There's a lack of that additional, baseline to work from, right? But in addition, you know, there are plenty of tall women's basketball players who don't succeed at nearly the number of things that Imani Boyette does. You know, whether it's the shooting range, whether it's the rebounding. And her rebounding percentage, 24.1% of available rebounds, which is 10th nationally, you know, the first in the conference, of course. And, you know, that alone speaks to my mind, effort as much as just reaching out and grabbing them. And so I've watched a lot of Texas games because I'm trying to sort of solve this. I'm trying to get to the center of the difference between what Imani Boyette looks like to me and what some of her critics say about her. But yes, to my mind, Imani Boyette has solved a lot of whatever that problem is already, number one. But number two, and really significant, it also means that in terms of her critics, in terms of the potential downsides, if there really is more there than she's showing now, that is projectability above and beyond what she's already done at the University of Texas. And that's as much an argument in favor of taking her as it is a reason not to.
And that is why I wanted to have this discussion and this podcast this week, because of just that type of thing, so that everybody can get in and give their own opinions, and hopefully we'll start some more discussion on Twitter and on the message boards with this, because I agree with you. I do think that she is certainly worth whatever a gamble it is to specifically discuss about Boyette for a second. I think that she's a top pick because the fact that there is that growth potential, and she does have that incredible skill set for somebody her size. So, So that's why, you know, I love playing devil's advocate and having these discussions. And there's so many other people I'd love to kick around with you that we're going to have to do this again, because, you know, you mentioned one of my favorite players in the country, but we don't have time to go into it today, and that's Courtney Williams, who mm-hmm. I think is going to be a star in the Cappy Pondexter type of player, only she's with her jumping ability, but not her she's got to get a little bit bigger. Physically,
can get
I think.
Her own shot at any time from any spot on the court. That is such an underrated skill.
Howard, I want to thank you again for doing this, for one thing, and for taking time to go over it and kick around some of the ideas behind mock drafting and the WNBA mock drafts that you're going to be doing every Monday. We're going to see these on Excel Sports. Howard, why don't you tell everybody where they can find you on Twitter and read your various places, because you're in more than just Excel Sports, too.
It is true. You can follow Excel Sports, E-X-C-E-L-L-E Sports, on Twitter. You can follow me directly, at Howard Megdal, Megdal, H-O-W-A-R-D-M-E-G-D-A-L. And please, I would encourage you to reach out and talk to me about any differences you have with me on it as well. Would love to chat about it.
And also, let's talk for one second. Give the book a plug. You and Michelle Vopel, my two biggest St. Louis Cardinal fans, you've got that book coming out shortly.
Well, just to be fair, I wrote a book called The Cardinals Way. I did not grow up a Cardinals fan, although I have a great deal of respect for the organization. But yes, The Cardinals Way will be published by St. Martin's Press on February 23rd. You can pre-order it now, Barnes & Noble, Amazon, wherever they sell books.
And to be fair, Howard is a New York sports guy, much like I am, and that's one of the things that we have in common. You know, is a love for our New York sports teams. Howard,
one of many.
Thanks again, and good luck with the rest of the writing on the podcast and growing the website. And I look forward to catching up with you again soon.
Look forward to any interviews, David. Thank you.